everyone. Thank you for tuning in to the Postmodern Realities Podcast, brought to you by the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. I'm Melanie Cogdill, managing editor of the Christian Research Journal, and as you can tell, struggling with a bit of a cold, which I got after I recorded this interview with our guest today. It's January 2025, and you're listening to episode 428, which is a discussion about progressivism called SEL in public schools. On this episode, I'm joined by Bill Westers, who teaches at a public high school in Michigan. He also hosts the Encountering Truth podcast and graduated from the Cross Examine Instructors Academy and participated in the Colson Fellows Program. Bill has written a feature article for the Christian Research Journal. His article is called The New Religion in Public Schools, Progressivism, and the Trojan Horse called SEL. And you can read his article for free at equip.org. That's EQUIP.org. Bill, it's good to have you on the podcast.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, as I mentioned, Bill has written a very in-depth article for the website about a particular worldview that is in the public schools. Now, I just want to say this from the outset, because I would like all of our listeners to hang in here with us in this topic, even if you don't, let's say you're an empty nester, or you don't send your children to public school, you might homeschool or send them to Christian school, or another kind of private school that's not public school. But I think this is very important for all of us, for a variety of different reasons. We need to know what is being taught in the public schools. And I know a lot of Christians do like to be involved in their communities. And so this is very important kind of things to think through, not just our tax dollars going towards the public schools that we're all contributing to as taxpaying citizens of the United States, where we record this podcast, but also just to know around us as we interact with our neighbors. And this is an apologetics podcast. And as we have friendships and we're doing evangelism with family members or neighbors, we need to know some of the kinds of things that perhaps their families are encountering in public schools because they send their kids to public school. So I think all of us have some interaction with public school. Plus, Bill himself is a public school teacher. So this is talking about a new kind of quote-unquote religion in the public schools. And your articles state that there's progressivism and it's a new religion in the public schools. And first of all, I want you to define, before I ask you about, well, what does it mean, a new religion in the public schools, can you define for our listeners what you mean by progressivism?
Sure, definitely. When I talk about progressivism, of course, that word can have, you know, many different definitions to different people. When I'm talking about progressivism, I'm talking about basically this kind of a marriage between secular humanism and this neo-Marxist critical consciousness or wokeism. So secular humanism, you know, of course, taking God out of things, and one of their common phrases is we can be good without God and seeking progress and improving in reform in society, but without God as a sort of a foundation or standard for that. And then that's, of course, been kind of married to that neo-Marxist idea of oppressed versus oppressor, and this ideology of social justice and equity, diversity, pushing even, you know, some of the gender ideologies going on right now with the transgenderism. And so when I'm talking about progressivism, that's what I'm talking about, this far left, leftist type of secular humanism and wokeism or neo-Marxist critical consciousness based off those the critical theories.
Well, I also want to let our listeners know he talked about a lot of different terms and phrases there. I'm going to have our staff link in the description of this podcast some of the articles that we've done on these topics on the Christian Research Journal. We had a cover article several years ago in our print journal by Jay Richards on Marxism. We have had various different articles on humanism and can you have truth and value without God, and people who can have morality without God that they claim. So all of those just classic articles from the Christian Research Journal. We'll link them to you so you can do a deeper dive for further study. Well, now that you've kind of given us some parameters for what you mean by progressivism, how would you say that progressivism could be qualified as literally a religion?
Yeah, well, we know from religions like Buddhism, and even from a 1987 federal court case where a judge actually said that a religion need not posit a belief in God. So a lot of people, when you think of religion, their mind immediately goes to a belief in a God, but that's not always the case. And so a religion, according to that court case that I mentioned in 1987, was defined as a comprehensive belief system that addresses the fundamental questions of human existence, such as the meaning of life and death, man's role in the universe, and the nature of good and evil, and that gives rise to duties of conscience. And Merriam-Webster dictionary defines a religion one of the possible definitions is that it's a cause, principle, or system of beliefs held to with ardor and faith. And so the public schools today, they have adopted a cause that goes well beyond academics and even gives rise to those duties of conscience. They hold to this cause with ardor and with faith, and they implicitly expect their faculty and their staff to align their own beliefs accordingly. And so the idea is that these ideas that are being communicated, this idea of progressivism, that we can be good without God, and the ideologies that are being pushed in the public schools, they're being held to with a certain religious zeal and that ardor and faith that I mentioned. And so the idea is that when we remove religion from a particular domain in society, like we attempt to do in the public school system, well, man simply directs his devotion elsewhere. And in this case, it is to push these progressive ideas about social justice activism based on what they would consider the marginalized communities and this oppressed versus oppressor type of critical theory, neo-Marxist ideology. And so when you talk about the Marxist ideology, we're talking about different groups in society that are either oppressed or they're oppressors. And so whether that's man as the oppressor, woman as the oppressed, or the wealthy as the oppressor, the poor class as the oppressed, or it could be whites as the oppressor versus minorities or non-whites as the oppressed, heterosexual versus non-heterosexual. And you have all these ideologies being pushed in this public schools right now with such religious zeal that they're making these claims and basically all of these assumptions and just adopting this belief system and imposing that then on the faculty and in turn on the students.
Well, you're talking about a particular belief system that you're calling a religion that's being imposed on faculty and students, and I guess I assume curriculum too. You know, normally when we think of public schools and public institutions, one thing that's usually pointed out that there needs to be a separation of church and state. I think you mentioned this in your article. And so that's why we don't have prayer, for example, in public schools. So if you're calling this type of progressivism as a new religion in public schools, how come there isn't a separation between this new religion and this public institution? So how has it gotten into public schools?
Well, first of all, to clarify, when it comes to the separation of church and state, that's an often misunderstood expression in our country right now, because it's not actually in the Constitution. It's from a letter in 1802 from Thomas Jefferson to the Danbury Baptists, who were afraid that the government was going to basically establish a national church. And so he was trying to assure them that the government was not going to interfere with their religious freedoms. or establish a particular denomination as the state church or the national church, like what they were basically fleeing from in England when they came to the New World, so to speak. And so that's an often misunderstood thing. But now what we do have in the Constitution is the Establishment Clause that says Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion. And then the Free Exercise Clause that comes right after that, or prohibiting the exercise thereof. Now, in a recent case in Louisiana, I mentioned this in the article, that there was a law that was passed in Louisiana that said that the Ten Commandments, a poster of the Ten Commandments, had to be posted in every public school classroom throughout the state. Now, it's not clear what religion that was supposedly to establish, or how it might establish a particular religion from the government's perspective. But the Ten Commandments law was actually blocked by a federal judge, saying that it did somehow establish a religion. Of course, which religion that was, there are multiple religions that acknowledge the Ten Commandments. But even that has been incorrectly interpreted, that religion, you know, has no place in government, but when it actually should be that the government should stay out of religion. So how did they get past this, you know, to incorporate this religion of progressivism into the public schools? Well, of course, they have to basically strip it of any kind of religious sounding language. And they have to rely on these ideas of secular humanism, which, by the way, was actually in that court case I mentioned earlier in the 1987, with secular humanism itself, this idea of good without God was actually considered to be the equivalent of a religion. And so the only way to incorporate this is to basically strip it of all religious sounding language, and they have to connect it with this idea of empathy and compassion, and then frame it in this natural sounding language of safety and belonging. And so they connect it with secular humanism, which talks about, you know, their goal is to cultivate moral excellence, but of course detaching religion and a belief in God from that. And so by using this safety and belonging type of language and connecting it with empathy and compassion, things that everybody agrees are good and positive things, they are able to push this in the public school, even though it has very much become a sort of religion.
Well, you just touched on it a moment ago, but when we think about religion, we also think about ways in which a system of belief would encourage human flourishing, which would also encourage ethics and morality. And so some of those things that we associate with religion, but it's not being defined literally as a religion. So if it is operating as one, and you talked about having moral excellence, how are they basing their morality as they teach this quote-unquote religion?
Yeah, they have what I call a moral problem, because they've removed religion from the picture. And so all they're left with is this grounding of naturalistic philosophy, where, you know, which is basically at the foundation of its atheistic ideologies, the secular humanism and the neo-Marxism that is based on both being atheistic. And so it has to be rooted in that naturalistic philosophy. Well, the problem is that they have eliminating and taking God and traditional religion out of it, they have eliminated the very standard of morality itself, which is God himself. And there's no way to ground moral values or explain the guilt that humans feel when we break the moral law. And so essentially what happens is that man becomes divided. And I talk about how Francis Schaeffer mentions this division between what he calls a lower story of facts and nature, versus an upper story of beliefs and values and morals. And really, they kind of base everything in this factual, natural, lower story, but they still want to believe that morals are a real thing. But in order to do that, when you take away the standard, there's no way to ground that in anything. And so they literally would basically have to take a leap of faith to believe that morals are even a real thing. And so it's this kind of leap of faith, of this division of man, and all they're left with then is this works-based type of salvation, where I would argue that the critical theories, that oppressed versus oppressor framework that I mentioned earlier, becomes really just the only standard for measuring moral goodness, and that's just been picked out of history. It's not any even grounded in anything objective, and so that it becomes something where they, you know, now have to do the works of this works-based salvation of progressivism, where they're recognizing privilege and divesting themselves of power and privilege, and where they have to fight oppression and read the sacred texts of anti-racism or do the salvific or redemptive work of social justice. And of course, they have to virtual signal. As this is all, if you see this out there, it's, you know, it, sometimes it's hard for us to understand what's going on, but really this is what's making them feel redeemed. This is where they find their redemption by doing all of these actions. It helps them to actually feel like good people. And of course, you know, as Christians, we know that all of our righteous acts are like filthy rags. But when you eliminate God as the standard of objective morality, then there is no standard for goodness, and it's all preferences. It all becomes relative. You know, C.S. Lewis talks about that you can't know that a stick is crooked or a line is crooked unless you know what the straight line is. And so, you know, they've taken this ideology and, you know, taken God out of it, and now it's, everything becomes relative. But in their minds, you know, they base it in their what they feel. They kind of probably don't even recognize the fact that there's no grounding, no way to actually say this is good except for their personal preference. You know, we actually had a superintendent during COVID say, you know, make the claim in an email when it came to, you know, wearing masks and all that, regardless of what people's beliefs are about that. The superintendent sent out a memo saying, as educators, it is our moral duty to model healthy behavior for our students. And, you know, whether that's true or false, you have to have a baseline for that. You have to have some sort of objective standard to make that type of claim. And so they're left with this moral problem that they choose what they think is good based off of most of the time would be critical theory framework or neo-Marxism. But they just have to pick some subjective standard and base everything else that they do off of it.
So you're saying that this progressive religion has this moral problem. So how do they solve this moral problem? How do they effectively teach kids what good morality is? You mentioned that, you know, people should try to be examples towards the kids and have, you know, good behavior, but how do they define that? What is the standard by which they're encouraging faculty to show and teach morality to the students?
Well, they have to come up with a creative workaround to be able to teach that that quote unquote moral excellence that I mentioned to the students. And yes, they base the standard off of some of the neo-Marxist oppressed versus oppressor framework. But going back to the Ten Commandments law, you can see a little bit of what is happening here and how they get around this moral problem, because the ACLU, the Americans United for Separation of Church and State, and the Freedom from Religion Foundation, they issued a statement when that law was first passed in Louisiana about the Ten Commandments. They said that all students should feel safe and welcome in our public schools. They go on to say that HB 71 would undermine this critical goal and prevent schools from providing an equal education to all students, regardless of faith. Now, what's happening here is, if you start to pay attention to some of the language that is used, you can see language like safety, that they should feel safe and welcome. That is the language being used today in public schools and in a lot of other places as well, but especially in these public schools, the, one of the biggest focuses today is safety, belonging, inclusion, and equity. And my argument is that I really believe that this is, goes back to something that they've used for a very long time in the public schools, as well as other social sciences and whatnot, but this is Maslow's hierarchy of needs. Now, if you're familiar with Maslow's hierarchy of needs, it's been around since, I believe, like 1943, created by Abraham Maslow. And it's basically this triangle hierarchy where at the very bottom, it's basically giving the idea of what is necessary for human flourishing and advancement and, you know, productivity and whatnot. And so at the very bottom, of course, in order for students to learn and go on to the next level, you will see physiological needs, very, you know, obvious physiological needs like food, water, shelter. Everybody needs that before they can move on to the next phase. The next need, which right above that physiological need, is that need for safety and security. And so very, very foundational need. And right above that next, that level of safety and security, you come to that third level of love and belonging. And so right there, we can see the safety and the belonging. And so the way that they're going about this is trying to frame it in this very natural sounding, factual sounding words, going back to like Francis Schaeffer's Lower Story, where these, this idea of safety and belonging are two things that are fundamental to human flourishing and advancement. And of course, when you can frame these, this progressive ideology in this manner, well, that basically gives you impetus to incorporate that into public school education. They get around that moral problem by making it all about what is factual and natural.
So one of the things that you talk about in your article is something that's, you use the acronym SEL, and it's social emotional learning that you just mentioned briefly. And so this is really interesting because it's kind of some of the bedrock things for progressivism. So can you tell us what is SEL and how is it used in the public schools? Is it just, I'm curious, is it just in curriculum? Is it just trying to weave it through every part, like in sports for coaches? How is it being deployed to influence students?
Yeah, social emotional learning is basically, it's a program that is, it's growing very quickly in popularity all throughout the country in public schools. It's made its way into some Christian schools as well, and private schools, but it's really all about healthy identities, managing emotions, feeling and showing empathy, developing relationship skills, making responsible and caring decisions. And it's not so much a curriculum that's being taught, although there is some of that, but it's really become the filter through which all of the other curriculum is being taught in the public schools. And so, you know, of course, you listen to that list that I gave you of the healthy identities and managing emotions and feeling and showing empathy and everything. And it sounds very positive, and it's hard to argue with. You know, those are all good things that, yeah, who wouldn't want their kids to develop healthy identities and learn how to manage their emotions and work on relationship skills and make good decisions? Everybody would want that. You know, going back, talking again about what C.S. Lewis said, that where it's attributed to him, that the most dangerous ideas are not the ones being argued, but the ones that are assumed. And so there's a lot of underlying assumptions and ideals here in this social emotional learning that, although it sounds very good and positive, our culture likes to co-opt language and change definitions and, you know, subtly try to use these esoteric meanings, definitions with exoteric meaning, like basically words that have meaning to the inner circle as opposed to what they seem like on the surface, that everybody else, when they see these words and they hear these words, they have one thought, but they often mean something completely different or have different intentions behind them. And so it really becomes this Trojan horse for all of those ideas that I mentioned earlier. This, you know, you can even actually see this on the CASEL website. CASEL is the Collaborative for Academic, Social, and Emotional Learning. And they're basically the foremost authorities on the subject. And so anything that you want to find out about social emotional learning, you can go to CASEL.org, CASEL.org. And there's a lot of things that you can click on that will give you different explanations of all the different aspects of it. But on their page, that you can see within their key settings, they quote saying, "Inequities based on race, ethnicity, class, language, gender identity, sexual orientation, and other factors are deeply ingrained in the vast majority of these systems and impact student and adult social, emotional, and academic learning." And then they go on to say that while SEL alone will not solve these long-standing and deep-seated inequities in the education system, it can create these conditions needed for individuals and schools to examine and interrupt inequitable policies and practices, and so on. So right there, you can see these underlying assumptions to get a glimpse of, okay, they're viewing gender identity as a real thing. They're viewing sexual orientation as something that should be affirmed, and that just these assumptions that there are inequities based on race and ethnicity and class and all these other issues. And so you can see those neo-Marxist assumptions. And that's, you know, a lot of what's in this social emotional learning kind of looks great on the outside. But when you realize that it's kind of an open door to be interpreted, and these ideas can be funneled in as a Trojan horse, it becomes a little bit problematic here.
I want to ask you a little bit more about this CASEL framework and that you mentioned, and something called the CASEL wheel. But before I do that, you know, you mentioned it's not a specific curriculum. So how is this particular worldview communicated to faculty or others that it needs to be part of the warp and woof of what they say? Do public school teachers have to go to specific seminars? Or if it's not a specific curriculum everywhere, is there something that, like, principals tell you all that, hey, we want you to read up on this CASEL framework? And how is that, like, disseminated, really, if it's not a particular curriculum?
Yeah, it's within all of professional development. You know, teachers have to go through professional development, you know, every so often. We have these professional development meetings several times per year. We start off the school year with, you know, a couple of days worth of professional development and with different focuses. But one of the focuses tends to be this CASEL framework. We had a professional development where we practiced this idea of circles, which is something I can talk about more, but it basically allows for, you know, the idea that students circle up and teachers get on their level, and you have a talking piece and you pass around the talking piece. It could be sequential or non-sequential. And sometimes they make it about the curriculum as an opportunity to say, okay, here's a question from what we're learning. You can answer it. Once you have the talking piece, you get to answer, and then you pass it to another person, and then they have to answer another question. Or sometimes it could be just completely unrelated to the curriculum. It could be just you know, how are you feeling today, or what's an up and a down for the day, you know, a pros and a cons about this, or what's something that you're going through. So that's an example of one of the things that they might teach. And so it's not, there is some explicit instruction, but basically it's a tool that's being used as, hey, we want to help students manage emotions. Well, you know, and this comes in when we'll talk about the Castle Five in a little bit here, but it's this idea that it's a tool that can be used by teachers to, you know, we want to manage emotions. And so what are some of the emotions that you're dealing with based off of identity issues or the like? So it's, like I said, there is some explicit instruction, but mostly it's a tool to use to communicate curriculum or to open the door for other possibilities of, you know, with the teacher autonomy. You know, the teachers have a certain amount of autonomy in the classroom, and they can kind of do with it what they will. You know, some, I of course don't incorporate it into my own classroom, but there are plenty of other teachers that grab onto the things that they learn about social emotional learning and use it as either an excuse or a vehicle to communicate some of their belief systems.
You know, I do want to find out a little bit more about the Castle Five that you mentioned and the Castle Wheel, but it's kind of interesting what you're talking about, just this idea of, you know, understanding emotions, helping kids feel better about themselves. I think there's a sense in which I think not just secular folks, but also religious folks have said that this is a much more anxious generation than the past. I don't know if there's specific, you know, people say it's social media. I don't know that it's totally social media, but there's more anxiety that they face. So, you know, of course, especially if you're talking about middle school and high school kids, your emotions are just a complete roller coaster. And so how do you apply that? I mean, I'd like to know specifically, you did talk about identity, so I do want to ask you about that. But I also want to ask you about, like, what about grades? I mean, do parents come to you and say, you know, not getting a good grade causes emotional trauma to my child, so would you change their grade? Is this a way in which grades can be changed, for example?
There is some of that. Yeah, it might not be so explicit and overt, like, can you change my kid's grade because they are, you know, getting anxious with a low grade. But there is a lot of, let's lower expectations because of the anxiety in schools today. And I think it was Jonathan Haidt that wrote the book, The Anxious Generation, which we have talked briefly about, even in our professional development. And that does have to do with cell phones and social media. And there's probably a lot of other causes to it as well. But there are, you know, they, because of anxiety, and that's, mental health has become such a huge thing. And that's really why this social emotional learning has kind of taken off, because especially after COVID, when people were locked down for so long with so little relationship in person and everything, that this mental health has become a crisis. And so there are people, there are parents and things that will say, well, my child used to get A's and B's in middle school, and now they're getting B's and C's. What's, you know, a lot of parents will have, you know, are asking for suggestions. Some have a little bit of a pressure behind it, you know, kind of putting it on the teacher of what, maybe the class is too hard, or maybe I'm grading too hard. But I think the expectations have really lowered over the years. I've been teaching for over 21 years now, and the students today do not have that same drive because they've really, and this is all anecdotal, of course, but they've received so much accommodation and so much easing of the expectations. In fact, I read an article recently that said, I don't know exact details of, I want to accurately say this, but it was something around in Michigan universities, just in the state of Michigan, the universities, the average grade, or no, I think it was 80%, 80 to 90% of grades given in university are an A. And what's happened? Have we lowered our expectations, or have students really just been that stellar and improved? And I've just seen that, you know, we worry a lot. And I think there's some merit in being concerned for kids' mental health. But I think we have to really, really examine what is the best way to treat this? And I don't necessarily have all the answers to that, but I think that one of the things that we've done is we've just expected less of them. And I don't think that is the best response.
I don't want to get too far afield of this main discussion from your article, but I will say one of my kids is still in college, and unfortunately, there has been a mental health crisis, and maybe there always was one, but now we have more firsthand reporting and social media, which might not have been true 50 years ago, but his particular university has experienced a bunch of suicides in the last few years. But when it suddenly happened at the beginning of the school year, one year where there was several, I want to say there was at least three in the first, 60 days of school. The administration, said this was bad, but it took a lot of, I think, parents you've got the parent Facebook page, they were aghast that there was not, mental health days. So then the administration had to build in mental health days. And I'm not saying that this is very serious that these suicides happen, but it just is an expectation. These suicides happen, and it is hard. I don't know how it directly impacted, say more than 35,000 students, but there's now this expectation, of course, somehow, even if I didn't know that person, just the knowledge that it happened is going to cause my mental health to go down and possibly my grades. So therefore I have to do this. So I don't want to make light of, trauma and suicide and any of those things, but I do think there's just much more of a heightened awareness, even with parents, than there might have been in the past because of more anxiety. And I agree. I don't know about the grades per se, but I do think there's an expectation of parents, as I see in the parent Facebook pages, with, I don't know how many parents, probably 8,000, 10,000 parents of a large university, is that there are just people whose kids, like, they haven't experienced it. They always used to get A's in high school. So what's happening? So, and it's causing them a lot of mental distress. So I definitely think that's part of kind of what they find themselves in. And then is it being more encouraged perhaps by something like the CASEL framework? If you can talk to us a little bit about the CASEL wheel and the CASEL 5, when you talk about in these terms to students, does that become the new normal that they expect that also potentially could cause more anxiety? I don't know.
Yeah, that's a good question of, does this help? Does it cause more anxiety, or does it help alleviate some of that anxiety? And so, and that's not necessarily my expertise, because I haven't dug into all of those details as much and done the studies that would be necessary to figure all of that out. But what I can do is kind of explain what this CASEL 5 is, or in the CASEL framework. And going back to that CASEL website, you can find this on there as well. But basically, the CASEL wheel, our CASEL framework, is a diagram of concentric circles, meaning that they share the center. It's a picture like a ripple effect. Like, so you have a center circle and then a wider circle and then a wider circle, broadening out from there. And at the very center of that, you have the CASEL 5. What they call the CASEL 5 are the five competencies. One is self-awareness, one is self-management, one is responsible decision-making, and then you have relationship skills and social awareness. And I think a lot of this is in response to the mental health crisis that I think we are all aware of. And I, again, as you mentioned, we don't want to make light of that, because it's obviously a major issue these days. We just have to analyze whether what we're doing is helping that or not. So the circles that I mentioned surrounding that Castle 5 is directly surrounding it is you have classrooms. This is where the SEL instruction and the classroom climate is. And this is where you have things like explicit instruction regarding SEL. Like I said, there's some explicit instruction. It covers some teaching practices of how we teach certain things and the launching point for that. And then it talks about the integration of SEL with the different academic curricula. And so they actually even use within this acronym of SAFE in how they talk about how the SEL curriculum should be integrated with the academic curriculum. And so SAFE stands for sequenced, active, focused, and explicit. And so, again, that just clues you into the idea, that language of safety and belonging. So that's the classroom circle. Outside of the classroom circle, you have schools. And so they're teaching the Castle 5 or making the center, the classroom that broadens out to the schools, the school-wide culture, practices, and policies. And then outside of that, then you have the families and caregivers. And of course, outside of the family, beyond the families and caregivers, is the broader community as a whole. And so, you know, on the website, you can click on all the different parts of this diagram to see all the different details, read all the different aspects that they want to communicate about these things. And just, you know, if you have a chance to do that, I really would encourage it and watch out, you know, pay attention to that language of safety, belonging, inclusion, diversity, some of those kind of buzzwords that might clue you in on to some of the other underlying assumptions behind the whole program.
So one of the things you note in your article about the Castle 5 is the self-management piece, and you discuss how it's connected, self-management is connected to mindfulness. Can you explain how they want students to think about self-management as mindfulness?
Yeah, this is a very interesting thing to think about, you know, especially when you talk about religions in schools. Well, the idea of mindfulness is at its core it goes back to Buddhism. And so when you're talking about the, you know, managing emotions, thoughts, and behaviors, again, it sounds very positive and important. Well, one of the current trends, you know, how you teach and encourage and tell kids how to manage those emotions and thoughts and their behaviors, that's kind of up for interpretation. But what's happening today is a popular thing in the broader culture as has kind of crept into the schools is this idea of mindfulness. And you know, there's even one of the leaders of the Castle website, organization, talks about how mindfulness increases students' emotion regulation skills. And so they do things, they use things like meditation practices, breathing techniques, and it goes back to that idea of Buddhism. In fact, you know, there's a website called MindWorks. And the founders, Bart Mendel, he talks about how Buddhist meditation is specifically associated with mindfulness and awareness. And so I'm actually a part of a Facebook group where we had someone come on and mention, hey, I have my child came home today talking about peace practice, and where they would sit crisscross applesauce and they would close their eyes and find their inner peace and use proper breathing. And some of the students even pinched their fingers together like a yoga pose. In my school particularly, we've had professional developments where an administrator has actually led us through these mindfulness practices of really like Buddhist meditation, where, you know, she would basically try to you know, empty your mind, which is very Buddhist in its foundation, where, you know, she would say, you know, ground yourself, take deep breaths, go through your five senses and find what makes you feel peaceful and happy. You know, what's your favorite sight? What sound makes you happy and smile? What taste, smell, touch? And we had to, you know, we were supposed to be picturing these things and thinking about them and emptying our mind of all other things and finding our peace. And there's even been times when she's used a Tibetan singing bowl during these activities. It doesn't get a lot, you know, much more obvious when it comes to Buddhism than that. You know, in fact, we have a professional development coming up in January, where we are to select different sessions to go to. And one of the sessions is yoga and mindfulness in the classroom. And, you know, and it talks about mindfulness activities to help cultivate focus, calm bodies, and reduce stress. And so I've even covered for a teacher, just to give you an example of, you know, sometimes as teachers, we have to cover if there's not if we're lacking in substitute teachers. Well, I had to cover for a teacher a while back where I looked on his desk, and on the desk, he had a book called Mindful Solidarity, a Secular Buddhist Democratic Socialist Dialogue. And so I, you know, want to give him the benefit of the doubt that it's not, you know, I just saw the book. I wasn't, you know, I don't know what he was doing with the information in the book, if he was just reading it for personal enlightenment, so to speak, or if he was trying to incorporate some of those ideas from the book into his classroom. But when that author encourages things like political activists and Buddhist practitioners to connect with and learn from each other and create social change, and it starts to throw up some real red flags here. And so combine that with the, you know, the self-awareness of the first of the Castle Five, you know, when students are encouraged to, you know, figure out who they are and so concerned with, you know, this gender identity, trans, you know, teachers really feel this type of religious duty to help kids, which is in itself a positive thing, but it's how do we define that? You know, if you're already believing as a teacher that it's good to help socially transition a child, a girl that believes she's a boy born in a girl's body, well, you know, they don't necessarily recognize that, hey, you know, the statistics show that about 80% of those kids could grow out of it by the time they turn 18. So they're trying to genuinely help with these mental health issues. And, you know, we've even had at our school been told that, you know, we shouldn't tell parents about kids that want a gender transition, you know, in order to help them feel safe. And there's that safety and belonging again. So when these kids are, you know, basically being taught Buddhist meditation, combining it with these, you know, this idea of expressive individualism, as Carl Truman talks about in his book, you know, there's a lot of problems that come from these first couple Castle Five just by themselves.
Well, if you're a listener to this podcast and you were not subscribing to the Christian Research Journal 16 years ago, back in 2008, we had a series written, it's more than 20,000 words, so it's almost a book length, over several issues by our late editor, Elliot Miller. One of the articles that he wrote that we published was part three of his series on yoga, and it was called The Call for Christian Discernment. And one of the things he actually says in that article, so you'd have to go and read it because he lays out a big case for it, is that American Christians really need to fight for their First Amendment rights to press for a consistent definition of religion in the public square, because there is the advance of yoga in secular culture at the expense of Christianity. And fast forward 16 years, and here we are. So it's kind of interesting. It's almost, you know, it'd be very interesting for some of our listeners to go back and read that 2008 article, because since that time, you know, Christians really need to do some of those things, stand up for their beliefs in the public square, because instead of lessening, I think it's only increased, as we've talked to Bill about some of these tenets of SEL and progressive worldview that is anti-Christian in the public square. Now, at the end of the article, you're talking about teachers, and they're kind of almost put into that role of being kind of a priest, a priestly role. They're like clergy, and they have become the adult figures for students to look to for authority, maybe even over their parents, that they look to their teachers to instill their values, their sense of morality. And so what did you mean by that, that they're kind of looked as that, you know, clergy or priests or something like this? And how did we get here where teachers are now a higher authority than the child's own parents?
Well, when you emphasize things like what they emphasize in the Castle Five and such, you know, the empathy and compassion, it becomes so overladen with these ideas, you know, that it's kids end up fixating on their individual differences and inequalities. And one of the aspects of the Castle Five is to talk about how this open-mindedness, right? And to encourage curiosity and open-mindedness. And so teachers begin to take that and they leverage that and they take the students' empathy and compassion in an effort to elevate the voices of the lived experience of those that they determine to be the marginalized. And so we have this incessant and obsessive comparison that with these already insecure youth. And so the teachers then begin to become like a guide, almost like a guru or the clergy of this religious progressivism. And it kind of becomes this breeding ground for the idea of intersectionality, where, you know, people are called on to identify the areas of their lives and identities that they've been, where they've been oppressed or as compared to others. And so the teachers guide the students through this kind of open-minded journey of self-criticism, where they to figure out, where have I oppressed others? Maybe I have privilege, and maybe I have to divest myself of power. I should listen rather than speak. And they begin to elevate someone's identity or skin color or something like that above merit. Then they focus on the participating in social justice activism, and so it really becomes kind of like this religious duty of the teacher to communicate and guide their students through this. And so you have, you know, even as in at my own school, every job description says that a candidate must have a willingness and commitment to include equity, social justice, and inclusion in all practices. And so they have this religious duty, and they guide the students through this, lead them to that critical consciousness or awareness of their own social standing or intersectionality. And then with classrooms being right there at the center of that castle wheel, where the teachers are the ones kind of facilitating the learning that's taking place and the instilling of values, this is the heart of the SEL instruction. It becomes basically like the sanctuary of safety and belonging in these, which are almost like idols in a sense. And you know, the teacher's podium is like becomes like a pulpit for them to be able to teach or preach whatever they want to, from based off of however, wherever they fall on that spectrum and however much autonomy that they're allowed in their particular school and classroom, you know, that, but the thing is that's the center of the castle wheel, the classroom, but that's not the end goal. The end goal, like any other religion, is that there's like this mission field, and their idea is to go from that center to the next ring out, which is the rest of the school, and then outward one more to the families and the broader community. And so essentially what's happening is the teachers now being viewed as the first and foremost. usurping that role of the parent as the one who's instilling the values and who gets to choose what those values are to be. If it's the teacher or the school, then how do they determine those? You know, of course, we go back to what we talked about at the beginning with, if there's no objective standard, they're really just teaching their own personal preferences of morality and values. And so then the teacher's doing that and pushing it out to the school and then the families, where really in a biblical worldview, the parents really should be at the center. And so when teachers are now using this idea of open-mindedness and instilling these values in the kids, you know, that they're you know, have now gained this idea of an open mind, and they've hoped that the kids will now take that out to their families and the broader communities. Now, in the CASEL website, they talk about the stated goal of the families is to have these authentic partnerships. But even if there's not an authentic partnership, you know, what do families talk about at the dinner table? You know, what did you learn at school today? Or, you know, on the way home from school, what did you guys talk about in class today? So the ideologies and these values that the teachers are communicating to the students who are now supposed to be open-minded are now hopefully in their minds carrying this out to their families to influence the broader society and community as a whole.
Well, I mentioned at the beginning of this podcast that Bill is himself a public high school teacher, and he mentioned that he's been teaching for more than 20 years. So after we've had this conversation, I think some parents who send their kids to public school might be having their own anxiety. So what it sounds overwhelming. It sounds not in line with biblical teaching. So what would you say to Christian parents who are trying to navigate the public school system right now, and they do have a commitment to send their children to a local public school for whatever reasons that they feel it's the best schooling choice for their family? You know, what do they do if their school has adopted this whole SEL worldview and some of the programming and just the different ways that it gets into the curriculum? And like you said, they might be hearing some of these very kinds of concepts. What did you learn in school today? Coming from their own children. So it's making them feel a little bit anxious because as Christians, they don't agree with it. So what would be advice that you would give to those Christian parents with kids in public school?
First of all, I would say you have to look at the teachers and recognize that they genuinely do care for the students. So none of this is to say that teachers are not, don't care about the kids. It's just, as we mentioned, how does that look? You know, we're going to strongly disagree on how to best care for our children. And so whether it's caring for them from a biblical worldview or whether our care is driven by progressive leftist ideology is going to be very different. And so recognize that, first of all, and give the benefit of the doubt. There are plenty of teachers that are not so far down that path and that do actually care and you can communicate. You know, I would first say when it comes to options, you know, I would, at this day and age, I would encourage parents that if you can, that you would avoid public school, homeschool, private school, go to even a charter school. You know, we currently have our kids in a charter school because not everybody can afford a homeschool or a private Christian school. And so we took whatever the next best option was that we could afford. And that was a charter school, which is not perfect and still has some issues. But if you can't get out of public schools, well, as parents overall, it's part of our responsibility to really inoculate our kids to bad ideas. We have to have discussion. We have to talk to our kids, let them hear ideas from us first so that we can, you know, talk about where those ideas might go wrong. And as parents, the other thing is to be involved and informed. You know, parents should be reading assignments and class notes from the kids. You know, back in when I was in school, the biggest issue was in science class, you know, that the focus was, oh, are they teaching evolution or what kind of, you know, Big Bang cosmology and everything, you know. But today, you know, science is, there can still be some issues with it, but it's more of the classes like social studies, where they might be teaching some sort of revisionist history or English language arts. You need to pay attention to what kind of books are they reading? What's the worldview underlying those books and the authors that wrote them? So I would encourage parents to maybe read those books with the kids. Pay attention to what clubs are offered and what clubs your kids are attending. You know, there's clubs like the GSA, which is the Gender and Sexuality Alliance, you know, or other clubs that might have different focuses that are just anti-Christian. Be involved with parent-teacher conferences. Make sure that you set up those conferences and pay attention to the curriculum, because if you ask teachers, they're not always going to be completely honest or open with what exactly they'll teach. They'll give you the surface, but they don't always go, because they know there are certain controversial issues that they don't want to have a debate about. But I would encourage parents to dig deep into that. And of course, always be looking for that language of safety and belonging, things like equity and inclusion. It's not always clear, but you have to look for those underlying meanings, ask for those definitions, and ask for clarity. And so just that involvement with your students' education and being informed, doing the things that you need to do on your end as a parent to make sure that you are watching over your kids and what they are learning and being exposed to in the public schools if you're not able to choose another option.
And I would, unless you're somebody who's actually homeschooling, I would suggest for all Christian parents to be involved in the curriculum of their children. My children went to an excellent Christian school, but I wanted to know what curriculum they were doing. And when it involved books I hadn't read before, excellent books, I decided to read them myself so I could have that conversation with my middle school student at the time. What did you think about this book about the Holocaust? What are you learning about it? So I think that helps kids know that you're interested too, so that when you have that question, what did you learn today? You could be more specific. What did you learn today about this book that I know that you're reading in class, whatever that is? Or you guys are studying, if you go to Christian school, you're studying this book of the Bible. What are you learning about this book of the Bible? Or those kinds of things. So I encourage all parents to be involved in your kids' education, whether you're educating your children yourself or they're being educated outside the home. Well, finally, on a much lighter note, Bill is a new guest to our podcast. So I want to end with some fun rapid fire questions we asked for all of our new guests. And so Bill, are you an early bird or a night owl?
I'm an odd mix of both. I have to get up early, but I can't get myself to go to bed early.
Would you say you're an introvert or extrovert?
I would definitely say I am an introvert.
And what is your favorite meal? In other words, what is your last meal? What would the last meal you would want to have before you go home to be with the Lord?
You know, just a good pizza with the works, a supreme pizza just made just right.
Well, thanks, Bill, for being a guest on the Postmodern Realities podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
You've been listening to episode 428 of the Postmodern Realities podcast from the Christian Research Journal. Today's guest was Bill Westers. He has written a feature article for the Christian Research Journal. His article is called "The New Religion in Public Schools, Progressivism and the Trojan Horse Called SEL." And you can read it for free at equip.org. That's EQUIP.org. You won't want to miss out on subscribing to the other podcasts from the Christian Research Institute. We have the Bible Answer Man podcast, which is published Monday through Friday with the best of the week on Saturday. It's hosted by CRI President Hank Handegraff and is available wherever you get your favorite podcasts. In addition, Hank has a podcast called Hank Unplugged. Hank takes you out of the studio and into his study to engage in free-flowing, essential Christian conversations on critical issues with some of the most interesting, informative, and inspirational people on the planet. And you won't want to miss out on the brand new podcast from the Christian Research Journal. Christian Research Journal Reads presents audio versions of Christian Research Journal articles. It was a print incarnation of almost 45 years. It's now on the web, as you know, with new articles every single week. So you won't want to miss these audio articles of some of our most popular and most accessed articles on our website, equip.org.